Well, thank you so much, and thank you for that generous introduction and for the invitation. I've heard so much about the Philadelphia Society over the years, and I'm very grateful to be a part of it this weekend, particularly to talk about a subject that is so important about the Constitution and the reasons for its decline. So let me begin by talking a bit about what is declined about the Constitution before going into some of its reasons. Of course, it's not a total story of decline. It's very important that from the original Constitution, there have been some improvements. Of course, the elimination of slavery through the 13th Amendment. And through the 14th, 15th, and 19th Amendments, our collective decision to give women and minorities the rights of white males at the time of the founding of the Republic. Nevertheless, the central aspects of the Constitution, I think, have declined. And how would I describe the central aspect of the Constitution? Well, I think it's its ingenious mechanism for government to provide public goods, to be strong enough to provide public goods without being strong enough to threaten our liberties. And how did the original Constitution did that? Well, it sharply limited the federal government in several ways, most of all by the enumerated powers, which focused the federal government on the provision of certain kinds of public goods that the market and the family could not. But it also protected liberty by making the federal government, in some sense, very slow-moving through bicameralism and presentment. You had to have very substantial consensus to create rules, national rules, and also through the separation of powers. You actually had to go through the legislation, and the executive could not govern by a fiat or through administration. And so that was the structure in which it limited the federal government. Of course, it gave substantial powers to the state governments, but they were limited by the fact that they were essentially in competition with one another. One way of thinking about federalism is that it creates a market for governors, particularly in a continental system with federal rights of exit. You can leave for one state. You know about the conditions in other states. That really limits the tyrannical powers of the potentially of the state governments. One way point I would make, at least in passing, which I think is important to make at the Philadelphia Society, which I think very much values the fusionism between classical liberalism and traditional conservatism, is that I think it's a very good structure for fusionism. States are able to make themselves decisions about the line between liberty and license, but they do it against a market. They can't go way outside the way the world is working, because otherwise people have the opportunity to exit. So those are a very powerful structure to do, I think, what the most important aspects of government are, to provide public goods without endangering liberty. How has that declined? And I think, as Gary suggested, there are many reasons. I'm going to focus on two of them here today. One is the rise of interest groups, and the other is changing views about human nature. The rise of interest groups, I think, is extremely important in explaining the decline of the Constitution. In some sense, of course, interest groups and the decline of the Constitution succeed because the Constitution is successful. There's a paradox about the Constitution. The more successful a Constitution is, the more stable and prosperous a society it creates, the more risks there are from interest groups who are going to want to live off that stability and society. And moreover, the more likely citizens are essentially going to fall asleep because they're going to be happy and prosperous. And I think that's part of the story of the Constitution's decline. So let me go into that in slightly more detail. Of course, the framers were aware of interest groups, which they called factions. I think they were largely focused, as you see from Federalist 10, on majority factions, rather than what modern political scientists like Manker Olson see as much of a problem, minority factions. The idea is that groups of minority groups that are single-minded. They can be business groups, they can be union groups, they can be identity politics groups, can bond together and by their low cost of organizing figure out ways of taking from the government. Also, another, I think, very important sort of hybrid group is groups that have that mechanism of binding around some identity. I would talk about the AARP and the rise of benefits for older Americans as part of that decline. How has that affected the Constitution? Well, of course, the point is that the Constitution has a lot of barriers to interest groups getting things for themselves, having exactions on their fellow citizens, and the interest groups eat away at those constraints. It's not good for them to have a structure where the national government is limited. It's much harder to have a very large Social Security benefits. It's very also difficult for interest groups like business groups or union groups to get legislation through, and therefore we have the rise of the administrative state, which makes it extremely much easier for interest groups to capture the national government. So it's in the interest for interest groups to get rid of the enumerated powers, to get rid of the separation of powers, and over the course of American history, that's what's happened. You may wonder what happened, why the public hasn't reacted strongly against this. And of course, there's a story of that in interest group analysis as well. People, particularly when things are going well, are rationally ignorant about politics. It's sensible to be ignorant about politics because your vote is less likely to influence an election than being hit by lightning on the way to the polls. And moreover, there are a lot more interesting things to do with your life than focus on politics. And that's become even more clear over time. The Lincoln-Douglas debates took time at a time when that was the only game in town in some sense. Now people have hundreds of cable television networks. It just doesn't make sense to focus on politics. Politics has sometimes been described as show business for ugly people. And there's a lot more interesting things going on in the world. And so given that you're instrumentally are unlikely to affect politics and that you have other opportunities, people are very quiescent and don't even focus on, as we heard, the traditions of liberty, which are important in protecting the Constitution. And so I think that's one very important story about the decline of our Constitution. I think any kind of modern Constitution which declines because of its own actual success. The other, I think, is the change in the view of human nature. The view at the time of the founding of the Constitution was of a fixed, given human nature, and I think there were three important characteristics about that. It actually partly came from the Calvinist roots of the Constitution. One was that man was as Richard Hofstadter has suggested, an atom of self-interest. But it doesn't mean that he was depraved through reciprocity. He could create, at least in small groups and through business, prosperity and even good social norms. And also there was a kind of natural inequality. And I think our Constitution is very much built around those ideas of human nature. The idea of self-interest reinforces the view that you need to have strong restraints on government. Hamilton said that people, when they get into a faction, won't blush to do things that they would never do in their private life. And that segues nicely into the idea that despite self-interest, at least when self-interest was constrained and used, it could be an engine of prosperity. Of course, the Constitution comes at the time around Adam Smith is writing his Wealth of Nations. And it's not surprising, therefore, the Constitution not only builds in restraints on government, it creates things like the Contracts Clause and in the 14th Amendment, the Privileges and Immunities Clause, which are actually focused on protecting the rights of business, not only because it creates wealth, but because I think the framers thought that that kind of use of interest are going to create good social norms. It's kind of the due commerce. A thesis that good norms come from people's concern for their reputation in private life, where people actually are paying attention, unlike politics, where they don't pay much attention. And finally, there's a sense of that the government is constrained in what it can do, because while we should have juridical equality, there's a kind of natural inequality that cannot be erased. And one part of the original Constitution that's a little discussed today is Madison's statement in Federalist 10 one of the chief objects of government is to protect the faculties which create inequality, something I think one can't imagine any politician saying today. So that was a view of fixed human nature that was very clear at the time, and that is, I think, very substantially eroded. I can't go into all the intellectual history for the reasons that it eroded, but there's an essential idea that man doesn't have a given nature but creates his own nature through history. And if that is the case, the original Constitution sits very uneasily with that idea. If our given nature is not given, if it's mutable, and if there is an opportunity for progress in human nature, a lot of the constraints on government seem to be an obstacle for man from collectively realizing whatever nature he chooses, some more utopian nature through history. And so note that change reinforces some of the change that interest groups would like, just as interest groups don't like constraints on the national government. So do people who think the human nature is more malleable. So do think that it can erode problems of natural inequality. All these constraints are just so many obstacles to that realization. The administrative state also rises because there are going to be people who, and maybe this is the only kind of natural inequality in the new view of human nature, there are people who are going to have a particular ability of knowing how to structure government, and we allow those experts to have substantial leeway. So this is all very much underscores what happens through the interest groups chipping away at the Constitution, and one might wonder, of course, whether the interest groups in some sense are also helping to generate these new ideas of human nature. But there's a very complex, I think, relation between changing views of human nature and the interest in breaking down the Constitution. Well, if that's the case, let me try to end on some words. Well, how can we revive the Constitution if those are the causes of its decline? The interest group analysis suggests that the Constitution may be revived through crisis, because then the people who are largely sleeping in politics, who are largely not present in politics, may be roused to anger and to change matters. Now, some people might think that's actually what's going on now. That's one explanation, perhaps, of the presidency of Donald Trump. And one of his key advisors says one of its purposes is to deconstruct the administrative state. Well, maybe. I'm not at all confident of that. But notice that if that's the case, you might think that the way of dealing with the decline of the Constitution is to create new constitutional amendments that cut back on the administrative state, or at least framework legislation that's extremely hard to change, because one thing that comes out of the idea that the Constitution creates its own seeds of decline is that you can't just be revere the founders and think the Constitution is perfect at any time. The Constitution is going to have to be renewed. And we actually may need more constitutional amendments to create more kinds of restraints on government and to substitute those that have disappeared. And so I think that would be the story of a kind of constitutional revival if you took the public choice view that it's interest groups that are the root of the decline, and to use crisis to create that. Of course, if you believe that the real causes or the predominant cause is a change in the view of human nature, that may be enough. That calls for a revolution not only of constitutional structure, but a revolution in the hearts and minds of people. And that may be a lot harder revolution to create. So while I'll end on two possibilities here, and both they don't seem to me enormously likely, one is a religious revival. The original Constitution, while it is certainly not to instantiate any particular religion, grows, I think, out of a view of fixed human nature, a fixed human nature that is a Christian view that sees not a depraved human nature, but one that has a certain amount of original sin, of self-interest, and tries to work with the grain of that human nature. Perhaps we could see a religious revival to bring back that more idea of fixed human nature. I think there doesn't seem to be any evidence of that at the moment. Sociologists of religion suggest that religion continues to be in decline in the United States. And I myself, the way I am a sociologist of religion, is I read the marriage announcements in the New York Times every Sunday. And I can attest that one of the most important sociological trends has been the decline in religious marriages or the movement to what we call the religion of the nuns, people who are spiritual but not attached to any congregation, and they have some mail order minister marry them. I think that, and particularly given that's a group of the elites in the Constitution, the equivalent of the people who would be writing the Constitution in 1789, that doesn't give me a great deal of optimism that we're going to see a religious revival anytime soon. Another view actually is a very secular view, because of course one could go back to the original Constitution and see all of these views of a fixed human nature as reflecting a biological view of man. And of course there has been, to some extent, a revival of the idea of biology, of man as having a fixed nature in that respect, in areas like E.O. Wilson's view of understanding politics in that way. And you might think that's a possibility of reviving a fixed and more realistic view of human nature. Again, being an academic, though, that view not only doesn't have much purchase in our universities, but whenever it's raised, it often gets a violent reaction. When I was an undergraduate at college at Harvard, E.O. Wilson gave this view, and people came and literally doused him with cold water, literally brought a pitcher of cold water to attack him on that. And so one can't be very optimistic. It seems to be the opposite of is happening in our colleges today. It's emphasizing the radical contingency of human nature, and those who seek to contest that view are often met with actual violence. I can't be extremely optimistic about that at all. I guess the only way I would suggest there's some reason for optimism is that if you have a fixed view of human nature, some of these schemes are going to cause some of the changes in the Constitution that depart from that are likely to cause some such disruption that they're going to create the kind of crises that may give us an opportunity for constitutional restoration. Thank you very much.